Welcome back to Dakota Midday. I'm Kara Hetland, and George McGovern enjoyed civil debate, and the McGovern Center will host its Civic Engagement Forum on September 29th. The question being discussed this year is, should religion play a role in 21st century politics? We'll talk with the two speakers who are coming to this forum, both this week on Dakota Midday. Today, Reverend Barry Lynn joins us. He is the Executive Director for Americans United for the Separation of Church and State. And Reverend Lynn, thanks so much for being a guest today on Dakota Midday.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Well, let's start with your answer to the question, should religion play a role in 21st century politics?
Well, my answer is no. I always liked when John Kennedy was running for the presidency in 1960. He went down to Houston, Texas, spoke to a bunch of Baptist ministers who were at the time concerned that perhaps he'd be taking his orders not from the Constitution, but from the Catholic Church. And he said, I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute. And if you can't give that answer, because that would be very controversial these days, then the best answer is, I have or I don't have a religious viewpoint, but this is an election campaign and it ought to be irrelevant.
Absolute separation. There's no middle ground?
Well, there's a middle ground that's being developed, and it's the middle ground that leads someone like Kim Davis down in Kentucky, the woman who will not sign marriage licenses, to say, I refuse to do this. I do not recognize the decision of the United States Supreme Court that calls marriage between the people who choose to be married a fundamental right. I don't agree with it. It's just five people's opinions. Therefore, I'm not going to sign them. And unlike most conscientious objectors, she says, I want to keep my $80,000 a year job in Kentucky as a clerk in the courthouse, but I will not perform my duties. That's an extension of the belief in religious freedom that, in my judgment, breaks the definition. Religious freedom in this country means you can believe what you want, you can claim other people are dead wrong, but it doesn't mean you can get subsidies from the government for what you want to do in your mission or your ministry, and it certainly doesn't mean you should expect a pat on the head, a blessing from secular governments.
Does saying that you're doing God's work, is that somehow becoming a crutch in some arguments?
Well, I think it's becoming a crutch in a lot of arguments, and particularly after the decision in the Supreme Court on June 26th regarding marriage equality. Now people are saying, well, you know, it's just the opinion of the Constitution as interpreted by federal courts. We don't believe in that. So there won't, not only will public officials in a number of states not sign marriage licenses, but now we also find people who say, we will not let a gay couple stay at our bed and breakfast. We will not cater to a lesbian couple getting married, anything. We won't cater them cakes. We won't cater them pizza. I was not aware until this came up in the state of Indiana that anyone actually catered pizza to a wedding. But as a person who just performed the wedding ceremony for my own daughter a year ago, when I looked at the bill that came out for the cost of the dinner, I thought, couldn't there have been a decision to have pizza? But this is the kind of thing, you don't get a right in America to say, I've deeply held religious beliefs, and even though I took a job, I won't perform the duties that I understood were a part of that job. When definitions change in the law, which happens in every state all the time, you have to either live up to those definitions and perform the duties that are attendant to it, or you have to find another line of work. And I know that sounds harsh to some people, but frankly, that's all you can do in an American system that is not rooted in the Bible. The fact that there are 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights and 10 commandments does not, contrary to what people tell me on talk radio shows all the time, does not mean there's any connection between the two items.
Now, I read that Kim Davis is saying also, or some of her defenders are saying that you know, when she took the oath to uphold the Constitution, it was before this ruling. So has the Constitution really changed with this ruling?
Well, some of us don't think the Constitution changed with the ruling, but we do now know that marriage equality, the right to marry whomever you want, of whatever gender you are and your partner is, that that is a fundamental right. The fundamental right to marry has been declared before, but only in June was it absolutely clear. Now, I have to say that Kim Davis and a lot of other people who apparently now claim, well, they didn't even know this was going on, but anybody who listens to radio or watches television or reads a newspaper for the last 5 years knows that one day this case of marriage equality would get to the Supreme Court, and frankly, most of my friends on the right, just like most of my friends on the left, knew. I mean, we thought we knew, we never really know, but we thought we knew that this would be a 5-4 decision on behalf of marriage equality. So I don't know where Kim Davis was living, that she didn't know this was a possibility when she ran. She's been elected multiple times, but on the last go-around, the Constitution lives. The Constitution's values change slightly. The definitions change slightly, but I think Justice Kennedy made it clear that that's the way the framers intended it. So this should not have come as a surprise to her, nor should it come as a surprise to anyone else, that this is what the law is. If we don't like the law, we can try to change it. You can try to amend the Constitution, but you can't simply ignore the duties that are now a part of the job that you have agreed to accept.
Now, this whole debate over religion and politics goes far beyond marriage equality. I mean, it can even go all the way down to a judge in Alabama wanting to have the Ten Commandments on display.
Yes, Judge Roy Moore, in a case we filed against him a decade ago, said that he was going to put his own copyrighted version, which I imagine upset Moses a lot, copyrighted version of his favorite version of the Ten Commandments on a 2.5-ton granite monument, put it in the new judicial building in Montgomery, Alabama. We sued him. We knew that this was inappropriate. When we won in the trial court and on appeal, he refused to move the monument. He went all the way, or tried to go all the way, to the Supreme Court to be allowed to retain it there. He said again, no federal courts don't have any authority in Alabama. And we did win, and a custodial employee of the state eventually did move the monument out of the rotunda of the building. The woman we represented as the chief plaintiff in that case unfortunately suffered mightily. She lost her entire legal practice. Everyone left her as their lawyer. She came back from a date one night, and all of the windows in her home were blown out with shotgun blasts. Whether they knew she wasn't there or hoped she was there, no one ever figured out. And this is the same judge, by the way, who ordered all of his probate judges, that's the name given to the people who do marriage licenses in Alabama, ordered them not to sign these. We represented 6 couples in Alabama who were not happy with that, and eventually they are now all married, and he had to withdraw his position because it was wrong. But to this day, he, and in fact the woman I am debating at the McGovern Center, does take the position that God's law is superior to that of the law of the United States Constitution. I think that is dead wrong, very dangerous, and really a recipe not for good government, but for anarchy.
Now, you're talking, I mean, there's also issues that are going on about, you know, kids who just want to have a Bible study at school. And that needs to be part of the separation of church and state.
You know, there are a lot of, there's a federal law called the Equal Access Act that permits young people to have any kind of meeting in a high school if there are meeting periods during the day for non-curricular activities. According to the statute, you can't require teachers. The teachers are not even permitted to control those meetings. They have to be entirely student-run, student-generated. I don't have any real problem with that because the statute, once passed, also allowed not only Christian students to have their meetings, which is how the law started in its drafts, And then it turned into something that provided a right for any student group to meet to discuss anything. So now there are atheist clubs mm-hmm. in schools, there are gay, straight student alliances, all using that federal law as the basis for having the meetings that they want. So it really turned into a free speech bill, not a special privilege bill for people who wanted to have Bible study. So I don't have any problem with that as long as there's no administration help in it, no teachers controlling it, no outsiders coming in every Wednesday at 9:30 to conduct the meetings. And the statute itself says all of this mm-hmm. and makes it very clear that it's those circumstances that make it permissible to do this.
The Supreme Court, it seems, so decides all of these issues of separation of church and state. And does it always need to go to a lawsuit to the U.S. Supreme Court?
No, it doesn't, as a matter of fact. And in fact, the Supreme Court rejects 98% of the cases on any topic that it's asked to consider. And that's been a pretty persistent percentage for the last decade or more. But many of these things can be resolved by reasonable people who make phone calls and talk through the issue. Just in the last week here at Americans United, we have resolved two issues without going to court involving the papal visit. Of course, Pope Francis is visiting three cities on the East Coast. He's not, I'm sure the fourth he would have come out there, but he didn't have time. But these are serious issues where it looked like governments were also embracing the religion of the Pope. And in one case, it involved New York, Philadelphia, one involved New York City, one involved a town near New York that was going to co-sponsor a giant video presentation of the papal address. But we were able to resolve these without going to court. Court costs are enormous, and we don't like to sue people unless they're so persistent that they will not settle it, that they will not come to a reasonable decision that we have to go to court. So courts we don't like to have to resort to, but sometimes we do. When somebody refuses to listen to reason or to look at what the case law is, maybe it's only one member on a city council that refuses to go along with his or her peers and insists that they fight this to the death, then sometimes we have to sue them. We have a very good track record of winning, and luckily this sometimes inhibits people from pushing as hard as they might have 20 years ago. I talk about a lot of these cases in a book I just came out a few weeks ago called God and Government. It's available in independent bookstores, if you still have them, as well as on Amazon and Barnes and Noble. And in it, this doesn't purport to be a whole history of church-state separation, but because I've been doing this for over a quarter of a century, it's kind of my look at what it is to be a participant in these major 25 years of church-state issues in the United States.
All right, Barry Lynn, I want to thank you for taking time and coming on Dakota Midday. You're speaking on September 9th at the McGovern Center in Mitchell, South Dakota, part of its Civic Engagement Forum. Thank you so much for being on Dakota Midday.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you. And tomorrow we will talk with the other speaker at that forum. You're listening to Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.